Content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the June 26, 2026 issue of the Week. For our cover drawing this week, we have Elon Musk. He is sitting on top of a huge pile of cash, looks like $100 bills. Apparently, he's in outer space because in the background you can see the outline of the Earth's globe. He's dressed in all black, got his arms spread wide, he's smiling. He's holding a model rocket, and he's wearing a T-shirt that says, "It's always sunny in space." The headline is Trillionaire Takeover. How will Musk use his unprecedented wealth and power? We'll pick that up on the controversy of the week. Start with the first main story. Trump retreats from Iran war, slams peace deal critics. What happened? President Trump this week angrily defended his agreement to end the Iran war as he faced criticism from some of his strongest supporters over a pact that makes major concessions to Tehran while achieving none of the strategic goals he outlined when launching the conflict in February. Under a memorandum of understanding negotiated by top officials, including Vice President J.D. Vance, and set to be signed after the week went to press, the U.S. and Iran pledged that both they and the regional allies would stop fighting on all fronts. That includes Lebanon, where Israel is battling Iran-backed Hezbollah. As part of the deal, the U.S. said it would end its blockade of Iran's ports and allow Tehran to resume oil sales. If unspecified benchmarks are met during a 60-day negotiating period, the U.S. will remove sanctions on Iran, create a $300 billion fund with regional partners to help Iran rebuild, and release billions in frozen assets. Iran, in turn, pledged to reopen the Strait of Hormuz to commercial shipping and vowed it wouldn't build a nuclear weapon. The deal didn't address the fate of Iran's enriched uranium, its ballistic missile program, or the prospect, floated by Iranian officials, of Iran charging fees for ships transiting the strait. Some staunch Trump allies hammered the deal, saying it rewarded Iranian defiance after a war that cost the U.S. tens of billions of dollars and the lives of at least 13 American service members. Radio host Eric Erickson said Trump had surrendered. Conservative commentator Mark Thiessen compared the deal to offering the Marshall Plan to rebuild Germany while the Nazis were still in power. The agreement was widely slammed in Israel. Right-wing TV pundit Yanan Magal called Vance scum and accused U.S. negotiators Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, of selling out their brothers in Israel. Trump attacked critics as stupid and said prolonging the war would have resulted in international depression. He shrugged off the concerns of Israel, which he called a very small partner, and said he felt no need to limit Iran's missile program, because while missiles can hurt a little location, they don't blow up the planet. Trump said the memorandum was not the final deal, and that if he's unhappy with its execution, we'll go right back to dropping bombs right smack in the middle of their head. What the editorial said. President Trump lost the war, said the New York Times. Warned of the risks, he plunged in recklessly, insisting that the conflict would end with Iran's unconditional surrender, the removal of its stockpile of near-bomb-grade nuclear material, and a halt to uranium enrichment. But the Islamist regime Trump vowed to topple remains in place, and the terms he's negotiated seem worse than the Obama-era Iran deal he tore up in 2018, which successfully limited uranium enrichment by Tehran. Sure, the strait will reopen, but that's merely a reversion to the pre-war status quo. It's a humiliating come down for Trump and a weakened U.S., which will pay strategic costs for years to come. We supported this war, said the Wall Street Journal, because a nuclear Iran would be an existential threat. Trump succeeded in setting back the regime's nuclear program and its military base, but squeezed by rising gas prices and unwilling to escalate militarily, Trump is leaving the job unfinished. Iran's pledge to not pursue a bomb is meaningless. What's needed is the dismantling of its nuclear program. And if Tehran won't agree to do that now, why would it do so after weeks of oil exports and other relief? What the columnist said. The Iran deal lands after weeks of senior administration officials pushing for an off-ramp, said Elena Treen in CNN.com. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent was fretting over the impact on the economy. Energy Secretary Chris Wright was worried about further gas spikes as reserves tapped out. Amid rising public discontent over the war, Trump's political team wanted to protect vulnerable Republicans ahead of the midterms. And Trump, with his approval rating below 40%, very much wanted out. The deal looks like a political death sentence for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, said Edward Luce in the Financial Times. Playing on Trump's vanity to get him to go to war in Iran, Netanyahu bet his own and Israel's future on the U.S. achieving regime change. Now that bet has exploded in his face. Meanwhile, Israel's greatest concern, Iran's nuclear program, hasn't been addressed, said The Economist. Its regional proxies remain intact, and Iran can still fire ballistic missiles at Israel. Instead of vanquishing the mullahs, Trump has thrown them a lifeline, said Noah Smith in his Substack newsletter. Before the war, they faced a dying economy and nationwide protest. Now they may reap $300 billion in reparations, along with sweeping sanctions relief. Fees imposed on ships transiting the strait could be a major new revenue source. And Iran now wields an important new source of geopolitical power. Before the war, the regime didn't control the strait because it didn't realize it could. Using drone weaponry, it now knows it can shut down shipping at will. Iran's victory isn't the most important outcome of Trump's foolish war, said William Crystal in The Bulwark. That would be our defeat. For eight decades after World War II, we were a superpower that stood as the linchpin and guardian of an American-friendly international order. Under Trump, we're a bully that lacks credibility among allies and enemies alike. His failed war against a far lesser military power will leave us both less feared and less respected than before, and it will leave the world more dangerous and its future less hopeful. The controversy of the week, referring back to our cover drawing. Musk, does he deserve $1 trillion? Think Elon Musk, the billionaire, was bad? Asked Arwa Madawi in The Guardian. Brace yourself. After SpaceX made the biggest ever initial public offering last week, the 54-year-old tycoon saw his wealth rocket to $1.1 trillion, more than the GDP of all but 21 nations. How much is $1 trillion? Enough to spend $1 million a day for 2,700 years without going broke. You don't have to be a socialist or even a liberal to find it obscene that when the U.S. minted the world's first trillionaire, when so many Americans are struggling to afford gas, food, and housing, But the worst news is who we minted. In 2024, when he was welcoming Nazis to X and returning an autocrat to the White House, I likened Musk to a Bond movie villain, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. That was far too generous. Since then, this chainsaw-wielding sociopath has shredded the U.S. Agency for International Development, causing 600,000 preventable deaths, most of them children, in a single year. And now is busy on X, rallying Britain's white population to firebomb and assault their black and brown neighbors. That this racist monster is a false trillionaire is a perfect symbol of our modern empire's decline and fall. I am not a huge fan of Musk as a political activist, said Jonah Goldberg in the Los Angeles Times. But the South African-born tech savant's colossal fortune is a testament to human ingenuity, immigrant success, and American greatness. Just look at everything he's built, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. With Tesla, he launched the electric vehicle revolution. His Starlink satellite network helped Ukraine resist Russia's invasion. His Neuralink brain chip startup may let the paralyzed walk again. And SpaceX could help humanity populate other planets. Musk is our first trillionaire because American capitalism, by its nature, most lavishly rewards the visionaries who make all Americans better off. How quaint, said Robert Reich in The Guardian. Until recently, yes, the value of American firms, like the price of their products, was set by supply and demand in a relatively free marketplace. But Musk and his ilk have dismantled the old rules of capitalism. In our second gilded age, the value of companies like SpaceX is built through hype, government connections that provide lucrative contracts and favorable regulations, and total arbitrary control of price-setting forces. Musk's companies do have real value, but he's a trillionaire because the system now effectively lets founders decree what their shares will be worth, then forces average Americans through rigged markets and index fund-driven retirement accounts, automatically tied to SpaceX's fortune, to buy those shares, whether we want to or not. We've been here before, said T.J. Stiles in the Wall Street Journal. A century ago, the same widening chasms between the super-rich and everyone else, between the paper value of companies and their tangible assets, provoked Americans to demand a progressive tax code and antitrust reform. Musk becoming a trillionaire on fantasies of asteroid mining could be a similar inflection point. Why would Musk care what Americans demand, said T.C. Sadek in The Verge. He now has more wealth, media power, and government influence than anyone in history, and will use it to do what he wants. It's long been clear that Musk is the wrong man to save the world, as some liberals once hoped he might. It's now the world that needs saving from him. Here's a good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for thirst. After multiple bars in the Boston area, where Scotland's national soccer team played its first World Cup match, ran out of beer due to heavy consumption by Scotland's tartan army of traveling fans. We've been here for over 30 years, and we've never seen anything like it, said Noel Summers of Hennessy's Bar. It's a good week for Southern Gothic. After a Louisiana man fleeing a DUI stop jumped into a swamp where he was promptly attacked by an alligator, impaired driving can lead to serious and unpredictable consequences, said police, after a drone team located the injured suspect emerging from the mud. It was a good week for grit. After the New York Knicks beat the San Antonio Spurs 4-1 in the NBA Finals to capture their first title in 53 years. Led by 6'2" point guard Jalen Brunson, the Knicks trailed by double digits in all four of their wins and mounted three of the six biggest comebacks in NBA Finals history. But it was a bad week for sore losers. after Victor Wembanyama, 7'4" center for the Spurs, declined to congratulate the Knicks on their NBA Finals victory, gave a surly press conference in which he insisted the Spurs dominated the series, and signed off by telling the assembled press, "See y'all, never." It's a bad week for political symbols. After Page, a 4-ton African elephant being paraded through the Texas Republican Party's annual convention in Houston, abruptly halted and, in the words of New York Times correspondent Lauren McGaughey, took a giant pee on the auditorium floor. Finally, it was a bad week for taking things slow. After complaints by animal rights groups forced the cancellation of a snail racing event in Nottingham, England, snail master Nicholas Dickinson called the city council's decision nonsensical, noting that in the less humane French snail racing scene, they eat all the contestants at the end of the race, apart from the winner. And we're on the briefing. The SAT at 100. Colleges that dropped the exam as unfair are now bringing it back. Why has it endured? What's the goal of the SAT? A dreaded rite of passage for generations of high school students, the SAT, formerly called the Scholastic Aptitude Test, aims to gauge a student's ability to handle college-level material. Last year, more than 2 million juniors and seniors took the exam, a 2.5-hour ordeal consisting of 44 questions in the math section and 54 in the reading and writing section. A high score on the scale of 400 to 1600 won't by itself guarantee acceptance to a selective university, but it's often a prerequisite. Yet over the 100 years that the test has been administered, its value has been fiercely debated, with critics saying it merely reinforces race and income inequality. Those allegations were a main reason more than 1,200 colleges and universities stopped requiring SAT scores in 2020 and 2021, instead basing admission on factors like GPA, essays, and extracurriculars. Since then, though, dozens of schools have reinstated the requirement. Standardized test scores are a much better predictor of academic success than high school grades, said Brown University President Christina Paxson. In an era of grade inflation, they reveal useful information. How was the test created? Before the SAT, elite universities mainly admitted students from a handful of prep schools, such as Phillips Exeter Academy in New Hampshire or Deerfield Academy in Massachusetts. In the early 1900s, when intelligence tests were becoming all the rage, institutions began considering general entrance exams. Princeton University psychologist Carl Brigham created what would become the SAT in 1922. When he modified a version of the Army's IQ test and administered it to Princeton freshmen. Yet bias was built in from the start. One of his goals, Brigham wrote in his book, A Study of American Intelligence, was to prove the superiority of the Nordic race. By June 1926, the College Board, an association of dozens of universities and colleges, had adopted the test as a general entrance exam. The first time it was administered, 8,040 students were given 97 minutes to race through 315 questions covering foreign languages, logic, vocabulary, and arithmetic. Word problems reflected the culture of the day, with one math problem asking, if a package containing 20 cigarettes costs 15 cents, how many cigarettes can be bought for 90 cents? How did it get so popular? Mainly because of the GI Bill. In the aftermath of World War II, some 2.5 million veterans poured into colleges and universities, turned to the SAT to help them evaluate the applicants. By 1960, more than 500,000 students were taking the test each year, and 350 colleges had made it a requirement. To meet this growing need, the College Board employs teams of teachers, professors, and testing experts to write the questions. For decades, though, that committee consisted almost entirely of white, well-off, highly educated men from the Northeast, and the test reflected their experiences, with word problems and reading passages referring to upper-class activities like sailing or riding. More recently, test makers have tried to eliminate cultural and socioeconomic bias. Does bias in questions harm students? While that can't be proved, there are certainly disparities in scores among different races and economic classes. In 2024, the average combined score was 1228 for Asian students and 1083 for white students, compared with 939 for Hispanics and 907 for black students. A 2023 study found that over 33% of children of the top 1% in income scored a 1300 or higher, versus only 2.4% of children from the poorest 20% of households. Wealthy families, of course, can more easily pay the $68 test fee multiple times, and many can drop thousands on special SAT prep courses. Such issues were cited in a 2019 lawsuit demanding the University of California system abolish its SAT requirement. In 2020, it did, as did hundreds of other universities, including MIT, Stanford, and the entire Ivy League. What was the result? Top schools received a larger, more diverse set of applicants. But before long, professors complained that incoming freshmen lacked even rudimentary math skills. I realized that for students to follow me, said the UC Berkeley string theorist Mina Aganajic, I had to start reviewing basic algebra stuff, like fractions. A 2024 Harvard study found that GPA alone does a poor job of predicting academic success in college in the absence of standardized test scores. Dozens of colleges, including every Ivy League university, have now reinstated a standardized test mandate, and 1,400 instructors in the University of California system have signed an open letter urging the state to do likewise. Failing to measure preparation gaps does not remove barriers, it states. It moves them into the classroom. Are there alternatives? There's the ACT, developed in 1959 specifically to rival the SAT. Most schools accept it in lieu of the SAT, and last year 1.4 million students took it. The Classical Learning Test, created in 2015 by conservative Jeremy Tate to focus on works in the Western canon, was taken by over 180,000 students last year. And Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has ordered all U.S. military academies to accept it in place of SAT scores. But are these tests fairer or more accurate than the SAT? It's impossible to know, and some academics believe that's the wrong question. Harvard economist David Deming says any test is bound to reflect the shortcomings and disparities embedded in the American education system. The problem isn't the test, he says. The problem is everything that happens before the test. Picking up a few of the best columns of the week. The first two come from the U.S. Deciding who gets to be a Christian. Pete Hegseth has reminded us why the nation's founders instituted religious freedom, said Amanda Marcotte. In the flimsy guise of streamlining chaplain services offered to military personnel, the defense secretary recently slashed the number of Pentagon-recognized religions from 211 to 31, eliminating Wiccans, pagans, Unitarians, agnostics, and other liberal-coded belief systems. Hegseth's list also went over the number of denominations it considers Christians, omitting the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. After widespread anger among prominent Mormons, the Pentagon backtracked, releasing a new list that did not label which sects count as Christian. But the fracas exposed a major MAGA myth, that it will be simple to impose their theocratic views on the country. A government determined to make the U.S. a Christian nation must choose which denominations it considers legitimate. White evangelicals like Hegseth's far-right pastor Doug Wilson make up only 13% of the population, but they're unafraid of marginalizing those they consider to be preaching false gospel, including Mormons. In Hegseth's theocracy, non-Christians will no longer be considered full American citizens. The myth that weed is harmless. Young people were sold a fantasy about weed, said Sammy Labou. My millennial peers and I had a tacit understanding that pot users were immune to the pitfalls of addiction or withdrawal. Indeed, marijuana earned a 21st century reputation as a harmless vice, much safer than alcohol or other recreational drugs. The belief that marijuana is safe has led 24 states to legalize recreational weed, even as the THC content in cultivated weed and gummies has quadrupled. But recent research suggests that nearly a third of weed users develop a dependency that leaves them sleepless and irritable without it. Chronic heavy users can have recurring episodes of nausea and vomiting, and in some cases develop cannabinoid hypermesis, with vomiting so violent they scream. When I recently took a weed break, I didn't just miss THC. My body hardly knew what to do without it. I felt unable to catch my breath and gagged and drooled into the drain. Research has found that weed can even trigger psychotic breaks and schizophrenia. Reformers were right to push back against scare tactics meant to keep marijuana illegal, but it seems we've overcorrected in our acceptance. This column comes from Russia. Putin's reign is finally cracking. Dictatorships can be alluring, said Andrei Zupov. Lenin, Mussolini, and Hitler all had their fans. Fools, scoundrels, and even smart people duped by propaganda. But all tyrannies collapse sooner or later, and for Vladimir Putin, later has finally arrived. Former KGB spy, he weaponized the spy agency's age-old methods of bribery, blackmail, and provocation, both at home and abroad. In Russia, he crushed dissent mercilessly. In the West, he corrupted democracy by funding radical parties and corrupted souls, Epstein and others, because corrupted souls are easily manipulated. But then he reached too far by invading Ukraine, and everything fell apart. What was supposed to be a quick victory, restoring a former Soviet republic to the heart of the empire, became a grinding conflict of skyrocketing casualties. Putin has now been reduced to begging North Korea for reinforcements and borrowing missiles and drones from Iran. The economy is wrecked. Russians are fed up. And a resurgent Ukraine is now striking Moscow itself. The Russia Day celebrations in Red Square had to be canceled, a first. Once loyal satellites like Moldova, Hungary, and Armenia are daring to turn their backs. Even old spiritual sympathizers like Donald Trump are distancing themselves from a damp rot and hopelessness. Putin is learning an old KGB lesson. Nobody likes a loser. Time for the last word, our feature article. Title is Reality Check. AI-generated images have left us questioning what is real, said Kai Kupfer-Schmidt in Science. But the godfather of digital forensics, Harry Farid, is not giving up yet. Excuse me, that's Hanny Farid. Was it real? The clip showed a downward streak of black through a clear blue sky. The silhouette of a U.S. Tomahawk missile, like a metallic bird of prey diving for the kill. Then the impact, a plume of black smoke rising over buildings, palm trees, and electrical wires. By the time the video arrived in Hanny Farid's inbox on a Sunday morning in March, experts had already confirmed the scene showed Minab, the city in southern Iran where a missile strike had killed more than 150 people at a girls' elementary school a week earlier. The U.S. government had denied responsibility, claiming a rogue Iranian missile was to blame. But the video, released overnight by an Iranian news agency, told a different story. Journalists had emailed Farid's company, Get Real Security, asking them to verify the footage. Farid, a specialist at the University of California, Berkeley, is one of the world's leading experts in determining whether a photo or video has been manipulated. Since helping found the field of digital forensics more than 20 years ago, he has kept pace with massive technological change. I would consider him to be sort of the dean of digital forensics because he's been at it for so long, said Santiago León, former director of photography at the Associated Press, who now works on online safety at Adobe. In AI, Farid is facing his biggest challenge yet. That Sunday morning, settling in front of a computer with his wife, Emily Cooper, in their home in the hills over Berkeley, Farid went to work. His first impulse was to be suspicious. The war in Iran had already produced a fire hose of AI-generated images. Why had it taken a week for this video to become public? The low resolution of the footage did not help his confidence either. Farid first examined the explosion. AI explosions tend to be overly dramatic, he says, with a lot of fire and very billowy smoke. But this one seemed realistic. Just days earlier, he had finished writing a paper with his colleagues, Sarah Barrington, about what AI gets wrong about explosions. The crucial question, however, was the Tomahawk missile. Flipping through the video frame by frame in his office 2 days later, Farid pointed out the shape visible in five consecutive frames. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, boom. That's all you have, he said. Adding the small silhouette to real footage of the explosion would not have been hard. You don't need AI for that, Farid said. That's 10 minutes in Photoshop. Getting the physics right, however, would be much trickier, even for AI. Tomahawks are self-propelled, but over the short distance seen in the video, the missile should be plummeting in a straight line, he says. When Farid laid the five frames on top of each other digitally and aligned them, the missile fell as expected. After about an hour of working on the problem that Sunday morning, Farid sent the journalists his first assessment. The video seemed likely to be real, but he wasn't satisfied. Later that day, Farid decided to check one more thing. Was the missile the right size? A Tomahawk is about 15 to 20 feet long. In the video, it extended for 46 pixels. Assuming the video was shot on a standard phone camera, Farid calculated it would have been taken about 100 yards away from the missile, a realistic distance. He then measured the gap between the moment the viewer sees the missile strike and the crash of the explosion, caused by the sound's travel time. It was 1/3 of a second, again giving a distance of about 100 yards. Getting the movement of a faked missile right on the shaky video and ensuring its size matched the distance would have required some serious expertise. I've seen lots of disinformation out of the Iranian news agency, they're not that sophisticated. As a researcher first at Dartmouth College and then at UC Berkeley, Farid has been engaged in an arms race with technology. The advent of digital photography, ever more sophisticated editing tools, and now AI. His basic approach, in which he scours images for telltale signs of digital manipulation, hasn't changed. But now, instead of thinking about the artifacts left behind by photoshopping, he thinks about the clues left behind by AI generation as well. Colleagues describe Farid as calm and magnetic, but his seeming serenity is at odds with the story he tells these days of unregulated AI companies pushing the world ever closer to a dystopian future where nobody believes anything. The companies, he said, will burn the effing place to the ground. This year has already seen public understanding of major events muddied by AI-manipulated images and videos, but few events have unleashed as much AI imagery as the war with Iran. Social media is awash with fake videos of burning buildings, crying soldiers, and downed jets, says Darren Linville, co-director of the Media Forensics Hub at Clemson University. The images are more compelling than reality, he says. In terms of what people want to share and what people want to see, a lot of the AI content is better than the real thing, he says. The explosions are bigger, the camera angles better. It's like what you would expect to see in the movies. It was another war in the Middle East that brought Farid to the U.S. He was born in 1966 in Mülheim, Germany, where his father was doing his PhD in chemistry. Farid's parents were Egyptian and had planned to move back home to Cairo. But when the Six-Day War between Israel and Egypt broke out in 1967, they decided to look for work elsewhere. They just didn't think there was a future there, Farid says. The family moved to Rochester, New York, where his dad took a job at the photography company Eastman Kodak. Farid enrolled at the University of Rochester and went on to complete a PhD in computer science at the University of Pennsylvania. In the late 1990s, as a postdoc at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, he found himself at the library browsing a book called Federal Rules of Evidence and landed on a passage about introducing photographs into a court of law. It said, "There's this new digital format, and we are going to treat it the same as a 35mm negative," Farid calls. I remember thinking, wow, that sounds like a bad idea. The history of manipulating photos is as old as photography itself. A famous portrait of Abraham Lincoln actually shows his head superimposed on the body of the politician John Calhoun. Stalin airbrushed enemies out of his photos, and two girls from Yorkshire convinced legions of people, including Sherlock Holmes creator Arthur Conan Doyle, that their photos of fairies were real. But these fakes were rare, Farid says. It was clear to him that this was about to change. I just started thinking, what happens when everything becomes digital and malleable? How to be sure a digital image was real nagged at him for years. Then one day, Farid, by then an assistant professor at Dartmouth, was playing around on Photoshop, grafting the head of a colleague who routinely beat him at tennis onto the body of Andre Agassi. For the head to fit the body, Farid had to increase its size. He realized that the computer essentially had to create new pixels by extrapolating from the existing pixels, and that would leave a detectable trace, a statistical correlation between different pixels. Farid suddenly understood that he had been thinking about the problem the wrong way. The question was not how to authenticate a digital image, but how to find traces left behind by specific types of manipulation. I realized this is going to be more of a patchwork of forensic techniques that come together to tell a story about a piece of content. Like an investigation, he says. By 2005, the year Farid began to publish papers on this patchwork of techniques, the world of digital images was changing fast. His methods worked well on a photo taken straight from a digital camera, But increasingly, photos were being compressed and shared on the internet. And if images were compressed after manipulation, much of the information that Fareed relied on was gone. It was a high-profile forgery that helped Fareed realize the solution lay in physics. During the 2004 U.S. presidential election, a photo showing Democratic candidate John Kerry next to actress Jane Fonda at an anti-Vietnam War protest had created a stir before being exposed as a fake made from two separate photos. Combining people from different photos in this way should lead to a detectable differences in the lighting, Fareed reasoned, something he could look out for when authenticating images. He began asking the same question he would ask 20 years later when he analyzed the video from Iran. Is this scene consistent with the physics of the real world? Shadows are amazing. Lighting is amazing. Geometry is amazing, he says. 3D reconstruction is a huge part of what I do. It is a boon for Fareed that humans are surprisingly bad at dealing with shadows and reflections. Crucially for now, so are AI image generators. In the beginning, AI images were often easy to detect because they lacked some of the subtle statistical signatures found in real photographs, such as sensor noise or lens artifacts. But image generators have become better at reproducing those patterns, and now they can add realistic-looking noise and imperfections. And because AI images are created from scratch rather than altered in conventional editing software, some of the methods Fareed first developed no longer work well, if at all. But when it comes to shadows, reflections, and other physical cues, the story is different. Generative AI doesn't know about physics, doesn't know about geometry, and it does all kinds of crazy shit, Fareed said. These features can surface in unexpected ways. A few years ago, Fareed gave a talk in which he showed a lip-sync deepfake, a kind of fake that can show Elon Musk endorsing a crypto scam or Taylor Swift announcing a giveaway of cookware. After the talk, a woman who could read lips came up to Fareed and told him that the mouth movements in the fake video did not match the words. That led him to develop automated lip reading software that could spot such mismatches, which he described in a 2024 paper. In the same paper, he warned that because of AI's rapid improvement, this forensic technique will almost certainly have a limited shelf life. That challenge seems only to motivate Fareed and his team. I wouldn't say it is part of the fun, Fareed says, but I do like being challenged to always be innovating and trying to stay ahead of the other side. Could AI get good enough to solve the problem of shadows and reflections or create realistic videos of something as complicated as an explosion? Fareed is skeptical. The real world is incredibly complex to simulate, and there is little incentive for AI companies to push their models that far. After all, the companies are not aiming to deceive digital forensics investigators like Fareed, just the average user, a much lower bar. In the past few years, the digital forensics field has started to use AI to defend against AI fakes. Researchers like C.Y. Liu, a former PhD student of Fareed's, have trained AI on datasets of images labeled as real or fake. The hope is that it will learn, automatically extracting some useful features from all the training data, that will help it authenticate images, Liu says. Fareed dislikes the approach. To him, it feels like failure. Not only is it intellectually uninteresting, he says, but it also creates a practical problem. What do you tell a judge or a journalist wanting to know if something is real? It's not right to go into your courtroom and say, "Well, Your Honor, I think this is fake because the machine told me so." Even if Fareed's methods help in individual cases, the sheer number of AI-generated images is overwhelming. Earlier in his career, he would get about one or two requests a month, he says. Later requests came every week. Now, it's every day. Fareed often gets asked whether he is ultimately going to lose. It's possible that there is someone out there who can create a fake that he cannot detect, he says. but his aim is to make it so hard that it remains out of reach for the vast majority of bad actors. Every time I leave my house, I lock my front door, Fareed said. That prevents 99.99% of people from breaking into my house, but not a locksmith. For more than 20 years, Fareed has, in a sense, been locking up for all of us. He has no intention of stopping because of AI. This was adapted from an article that first appeared in Science. And we'll get one of the obituaries. The Today critic who panned with puns. Gene Shalit, 1926 to 2026. During his 42 years on the Today Show, Gene Shalit was America's most recognizable and colorful film critic. Sporting frizzy black hair, a thick mustache, and horn-rimmed glasses, as well as an ever-rotating collection of colorful bow ties, Shalit became famous for both his distinctive appearance and his gleeful, pun-filled movie reviews. Bursting with enthusiasm on the show, he bantered with celebrities like Robert De Niro, Robin Williams, and Carol Channing, sometimes collapsing into fits of giggles. And he reviewed thousands of movies, often punctuating his observations with groan-worthy wordplay. Despite the jokes, he took his craft seriously. I will never leave a movie before it's over, Shalit said in 1987, no matter how bad it is. Born in New York City and raised in New Jersey, Shalit returned to the city in his 20s as a culture critic, writing columns in the 1950s for McCall's, Ladies Home Journal, and Look magazine. An NBC executive admired his writing, but fretting that audiences would be put off by his appearance, slotted him into radio work. But his 1968 tryout for Today went well enough to earn him a regular slot. And in the following decades, Shalit's punny reviews became as much a part of the morning as a cup of coffee, said the New York Times. He told viewers not to forego Fargo, called The Silence of the Lambs a great yarn, a reference to the lamb's wool, and in one famous pan pronounced Ishtar, Ishtarable. Still, Shalit considered himself a serious critic, capable of making an informal argument, said the Washington Post. He was withering in his dislike of The Shining, said director Stanley Kubrick, had managed to make Stephen King's novel dull. In 2005, he earned a rebuke from LGBT groups for calling Jake Gyllenhaal's character in Brokeback Mountain a sexual predator, a review for which he later apologized. Shalit's larger-than-life personality made him a star in his own right, said The Hollywood Reporter. Over the years, he was parodied on TV shows including The Muppet Show, Saturday Night Live, and Family Guy, and voiced characters based on himself on The Critic and SpongeBob SquarePants. He is the Today Show, said host Meredith Vieira in a tribute for his 2010 retirement. Shalit shrugged off those who believed his brand of silliness had no place in film criticism. Even if they make fun of me, he said, they remember me, too. On the Talking Points page now, Social Security, the clock is ticking. Social Security is facing a looming financial crisis, said Joel L. Naroff in the Philadelphia Inquirer. The program's trustees warned last week that a trust fund that helps pay benefits to more than 75 million retirees and survivors will be depleted by the end of 2032, about 3 months earlier than projected last year. Social Security wouldn't collapse at that point, but incoming revenue from payroll taxes and taxes on benefits would cover only 78% of scheduled payments, forcing automatic benefit cuts. For a middle-class income household, that could equate to a loss of up to $18,000 a year. Washington has long known a crisis was coming. Social Security has paid out more than it received since 2010. And that shortfall has gotten worse in recent years because of drops in the birth rate and reduced immigration, which result in fewer younger workers paying taxes, and because of the tax cut passed by congressional Republicans last year. This mess should be dominating midterm campaigns, said L.Z. Granderson in the Los Angeles Times. But politicians won't touch the issue out of fear of scaring voters with talk of tax hikes or benefit cuts. Lawmakers can't hide from this much longer, said National Review in an editorial. If they wait around for fund exhaustion, they'll have to make rash decisions with harsh and immediate consequences. Better to act now, gradually raising the retirement age from 67 and making future benefits grow more slowly would be a good start. Congress has an easy fix available, said Robert Reich in his Substack newsletter. They should raise the ceiling on income subject to the Social Security payroll tax. This year, the cap is $184,500, which means someone earning $1 million in wages stopped paying any Social Security payroll tax at the beginning of March. But if all income in excess of $400,000 were subject to the tax, Social Security's solvency would be guaranteed forever. Congress is unlikely to pull that lever, said Jason Furman in the New York Times. Applying payroll taxes to all income would push the effective top tax rate above 60%. There are other solutions, including broadening the tax base to cover more forms of compensation and reducing payments to higher income beneficiaries. But what's more likely is that Congress will kick the problem down the road again, funding the shortfall by cutting money for children's education, cancer research, and infrastructure. People who receive Social Security, a powerful voting bloc, will be spared the pain. It's everyone else who will be made to pay. Trump, a distracting 80th birthday bloodbath. Only the hackiest screenwriter imaginable would script America's decline this way, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. President Trump celebrated his 80th birthday this week by hosting 7 bone-crushing Ultimate Fighting Championship bouts inside an octagonal cage on the White House lawn under a 100-foot-high black claw. In this tacky, bloody gladiatorial arena, fighters kicked and pummeled each other into submission. Surrounded by the names of sponsors such as Crypto.com, Bud Light, and Polymarket. The 4,000 spectators included the President, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, FBI Director Cash Patel, Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg, and Paramount Skydance CEO David Ellison. The spectacle was a deeply jarring emulsion of patriotism and bloodlust, history, and buy this crap, said Monica Hess in the Washington Post. After winning his bout, heavyweight Josh Hokett thanked Jesus before shouting, "Michelle Obama is a man," to a braying crowd. "We have always been a violent country, but have we always been such a shameless one?" Trump's alpha male roadshow is a telltale sign of weakness, said Catherine Lucy in Bloomberg. As he tries to end a wildly unpopular and frustrating war with Iran, Trump is using public appearances at sports events, including an NBA Finals game at Madison Square Garden, to project vigor and distract people from growing questions about his age and abilities. The octogenarian often dozes off during meetings and rambles incoherently. His swollen ankles budge over his shoes, and his hands have large purple bruises that he clumsily covers with makeup. He's up late most nights, posting up to 150 times on Truth Social, and for reasons unknown, 22 doctors participated in his most recent physical. Nothing can hide the reality that his political capital is declining. Polls confirm that Americans don't see Trump as so strong anymore, said Aaron Blake in CNN.com. In recent polling, 61% agreed that Trump is too old for the office. 53% believed he cannot handle the physical toll of being president, and only 16% thought staging a UFC tournament at the White House was appropriate. The fights ultimately felt like Trump's attempt to force Americans to love and respect him, said Jeffrey Blahar in National Review. They were staged on his birthday for his audience, his America. But he's visibly flailing as his administration unravels, and no amount of spectacle can distract from that. One of the short notes, white students now make up less than 50% of all Americans enrolled in public and private schools, from nursery schools through graduate programs. Latinos are today the second largest group of students at 24.4%, after whites at 48.8%. Temperatures in the Antarctic Peninsula hit a record 59.7 degrees Fahrenheit earlier this month, 3.6 degrees higher than the previous winter high set in 1998 at about 36 degrees above the normal temperature for June. We'll finish with a couple of short quotes. Albert Camus says, "Stupidity has a knack of getting its way." And Phyllis Diller says, "Never go to bed mad. Stay up and fight." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.